Hey, you know I'm going to Germany, right? Next June 1st through 12th. Myself, my wife, and you, if you want to go. We're hosting a 501st anniversary of the Reformation tour of Lutherland. It won't only be sightseeing, we're also going to do Bible study, we're going to sing hymns, we're going to have a good time all the way around. I will be available most of the time for your theological questions. You can corner me and force me to give you what you've been dying to ask. You can check this all out at wolfmuller.co/reformation501. That's wolfmuller.co/Reformation501. And if you don't know how to spell Wolfmuller, it's Wolfmuller. By the time this podcast comes out, it won't quite be out yet, but it will be out soon. It is the first of the ebooks based upon Rev Fisk Raw. It's the first episode of Brian Wolfmuller and I discussing eschatology. It's going to be released via Amazon.com. You'll be able to get it on Kindle. It'll be an ebook initially. We're only going to do ebooks at first until we have enough to really justify putting it into paper. But watch for that in the next couple of days. It is the first of what I hope to be many Rev Fisk Raw resources for you in print. Volume 1 of a Lutheran commentary on the end of the world by myself and Pastor Wolfmuller, A Thief in the Night. Coming soon to an Amazon.com near you. And I know asking for money is awful, and I don't like asking for money, but it's something I gotta do because this takes time and effort and work and energy, and I got bills to pay. So if you'd get a lot out of Rev Fisk Raw, I really would not mind it at all if you'd join my Patreon team. It doesn't have to be a lot, just a little bit to let me know you care about what I'm doing and you want to hear more, as little as $1.25 an episode. Every time I see someone come through with that, even at that $1.25 an episode, you better believe it's like, oh yeah, I should do another episode as soon as possible. It's funny how we work that way, but it's a way for you to say thank you and for me to keep the show going. All right, so let's get to it, eh? I'm not quite sure what this episode is going to be about, but it is going to be about Revelation chapter 7, verse 16. And the goal is to build on that and, with next week's episode, hit verse 17 and chapter 8, verse 1, and so bring to a conclusion, at the very least, Revelation chapter 7 and the seven seals of the Lamb's scroll. It's been quite a journey doing this thing. And I, don't get me wrong, I intend in every way to keep doing it. I just fear that the quality that I discovered as I was studying and then trying to bring forward to you will be one that I cannot maintain. And so the reason I've done these other episodes on other things is to try to give space to maintain that quality. But I'm not confident that I can do that, even so. And so part of me is like, well, I should just keep pushing through, even though I don't really have hours upon hours to go find that key story that opens every single thing up. It frustrates me, honestly, because I want to. And I want it to be good audio. I want it to be worth listening to. And that's probably just pretty selfish on my part. But what has happened as a result of this is that we're spreading out our structure understanding, and in some ways this is going to work against helping you to understand the book of Revelation. So the first thing we're going to do here is a little bit of review. And I know it's going to be kind of annoying to do this if you feel like you got it all down, but, well, there's just no way around it. We got to look at the structure one more time, even as we come to in the next two episodes. Really, you should consider the next two to be one episode in two parts. Even as we come to the conclusion of the first great circle of the book of Revelation. But see, if I say that and you don't, what do I mean? First great circle? Well, that's the thing we've got to make sure that you're grasping here before we go deep on what it means to not be hungering or thirsting or struck by the moon. And we're not talking werewolves here. No, we're talking the prophecies of Isaiah and 2 Isaiah about the goodness of the suffering servant of the Lord. So we'll get there. But first, where have we come? What is our real goal with the book of Revelation and this study, Revelation Unleashed. The real goal is to free you from the standardized but very, very wrong view of Revelation, which is that it's a book about the end of the world, and that the entire thing is to give you kind of a timeline for what's still waiting to happen before Jesus can come back. And if you've listened to the entire podcast, including the stuff with Pastor Wolfmuller, then you know what a foolish, foolish thing that is to do, what an unbiblical thing it is to do to start believing that we need something to happen before Jesus comes back. Because that is true, because nothing remains to be fulfilled other than unexpectedly, like a thief in the night, like lightning across the sky, Jesus to return with an archangel shout and a trumpet. Therefore, the book of Revelation cannot be a timeline for the end of the world. And it must be something else. But what is it? And to figure that out, well, we've got to read it as it wants to be read rather than with our a priori assumptions, our predetermined ideas shoved into it. And reading it as it wants to be read means reading it as apocalyptic literature. This is a genre and a style pulled from the late Old Testament, particularly the minor prophets, but also including Daniel, which speaks highly symbolically on purpose because it's written beneath persecution or at a time when there is no stability for the faith. So think Daniel in the exile, think John on Patmos. It's written in this symbolic language referring to and pulling on the stories of the people of God throughout history. We call that the Old Testament, in order to remind them of what has happened most surely and certainly so they may look forward to a future that is unknown but known. They may look forward with certainty based on the promises that they have received and wait for those things to come to pass over and against that great tribulation which they endure in the present. And we've talked about this too, how tribulation is a word that John likes, and he likes to use it to refer to his own time, not a future event after the rapture, but that he is a brother in this tribulation. As he sits on this prison island, it was no Caymans. It's a rock in the middle of the ocean. And on a Sunday, while he's in the scriptures, he is also treated to a vision. Perhaps, the last vision given with the death of the apostles, the end of prophecy, the last prophecy saying there's no more new prophecy. Look back to the old prophecy. Look back to the meat. Find in what has been said clarity. In this, though, I mean, certainly, he has words that are directly to him from Jesus for his present time, letters that he writes from Jesus to congregations in Asia Minor, that is modern-day Turkey, which he was a part of, was the elder and overseer of. He writes to seven of them, tipping us off, along with the seven stars in Jesus' hand, the seven lampstands around him, that there is some, again, apocalyptic, mysterious numerology and symbology that's going to be taking place. He writes these letters, and as we've seen, there's a lot to be found in them. But coming out of these letters, then, more takes place with this Christ, this Ancient of Days who is a man, who has revealed himself standing over the power of all things. And chief among this, then, is this man as a lamb, that is, as a sacrificial one, as an atoning and vicarious one. And we haven't done an episode just on the Lamb. We will. I'm waiting for the end of the book, end of Revelation, because it's all coming to bear at the end of Revelation, the exodus of all things. So anyway, you know, we'll come back to the Lamb. But the Lamb, you got to get the Passover, right? The one who stands in the place by blood painted on walls. The Lamb is going to, by doing this, reinvigorate or reopen the separation that had come to pass between God and his chaotic creation in order to make it all clean and safe and sound again, and even, shall we say, silent again. And that'll come back by the end of the second episode here, I hope, I believe. In this Lamb, not only has God and man, but creation and man, all living things as well as the whole church, on both sides of the events of Jesus Christ in history, 12 and 12, 24 elders, four living creatures, all angels and powers in the furthest extent of heaven. It has all been subjected to him and brought back to the Father. And this is the story he's going to tell. So he opens the book to tell the story. He opens the seals on the book and the story begins. Now, I don't know how much we talked about this back when. I haven't gone back and re-listened. And believe it or not, I forget about 2/3 to 9/10 of every one of these episodes. I mean, I do the work, I share it with you, and then I forget it. I wish to high heaven that I had a photographic memory, because I'd be a genius. but I'm not. I'm really not. I forget most of it. One of my goals is to get this stuff transcribed and edited lightly and put into a book so I can go back and read it. It's just because I don't want to forget this stuff. But in any case, to review either way, from this point forward, the entire structure of the apocalypse, of the book of Revelation, is running with numbers, right? So you have the prologue. Jesus shows up to John on the island. You got the seven letters, the seven churches of Revelation. You have another prologue of the throne room of God and the opening of the seals. And now we're going to have seven again, only it's not just one seven. It's not just one holy. It's holy, 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 which, by the way, was just sung in that throne room by the living creatures, by the cherubim and the seraphim. Holy, 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 seven, seven, seven. Three sets of seven. A concentric pattern. Kind of, if you can view it not like a timeline, don't think start to finish, although there's timelines within it, but think a concentric circle spiraling downward with a seven on each kind of edge of the spiral into a deeper and deeper awareness of what's being revealed. So remember this and think of it this way. It's kind of like, actually, we were just talking about this on Worldview Everlasting the other night, how the way that TV works, the way that video mixed with audio, particularly if you can combine words and music and picture moving, the way that it works is not always logical. The goal of a commercial is not to convince you to think, I should buy this because it's a good thing for me to do. It's wise. I need more ho-hos in my life, right? Or I need this new car because there's a good reason for it. The goal, really, the power, and this is the tool, definitely has this power. Unlike radio, it's kind of why I like radio a little bit more, is because it's a little more honest. The tool, a visual moving media with audio, is the power to get you to think not logically, but emotively. And so they take an image, and they take a sound, and they try to use it to get past your brain, or at least I should say, past your frontal lobe, past the place where you think, down into where you react, down into the gut, which technically isn't really your gut. You feel it in your gut, but it's the base spinal, they call it the primordial brain. It's because evolution just takes over everything the way they talk. It's so funny. I mean, as another aside, I was listening to another guy really defend evolution the other day, how obvious it all is. And then the next words out of his mouth, he said, we're designed this way, we're designed this way, we're designed this way. It's like, dude, you can't say that. Anyway, the primordial brain, the brain stem, the animal brain, the reptilian brain, whatever you want to call it, is part of our brain. And it's where your subconscious kind of lies. But it's not like your subconscious isn't there and isn't part of you all the time. It just doesn't think. It feels. And so the media images come flickering at you, either long or slow. But really, I mean, if they flash fast, they're doing it on purpose. Because what they want you to do is not think about what you're seeing and ask, did that make sense? What they want is every image that you see to create a small emotional move that over time broadens you toward a final goal that they have set for you, which you may or may not be able to think your way toward. And when we talk about it this way, we say, oh, that was so moving, right? That's the goal. Not to argue, but to move you. And this is what apocalyptic literature is doing too. This is what Revelation is doing too with these three concentric circles of sevens. These three sets of sevens, the seals, the trumpets, and the censers of wrath or of incense, is trying to move you with the images. It's trying to pile on so many images that it overwhelms your understanding senses and creates this movie-like movement. I don't know what else to call it. Which then leaves you with something you do understand or think at the end, but not necessarily by rational, logical argument. Rather, by the pulling power of the story as it piles feeling upon feeling upon feeling. The way that John does this particular then is in the structure of these three sevens. And it's really obvious, you can't miss it, but it is also not so easy to see, especially when you're trying to think linearly. So what happens is that the Lamb opens this book, this seal, the first of seven, and things start to happen. And you start to think this is an order, but no. This is the first seven are a revelation of a total picture of history. And we have talked about this, right? So that the four horsemen of the apocalypse are not a series of plagues we're waiting to happen and we're going to see them all happen in the order that they're released. They are a description of the fall. And the souls beneath the altar in the fifth seal are those who are believers, who are humans, fallen humans, who have had the results of that apocalyptic horseman curse, the cataclysm of our sinful condition, come to pass on us, including the violence which the entire world now lives beneath. And with the sixth seal, you have the it is, in a sense, the end of everything, but it's the end of everything first in the body of Jesus. The language is that of the end of creation, because creation ends in the body of Jesus put in the tomb. God dies. God dies. And the actual rolling up of heaven like a scroll that we are waiting for when Jesus returns in the twinkling of an eye, it is but the working out of what has already come to pass. This maybe isn't the prettiest image I can think of to convey it, but if you get struck with, say, the fallout of a nuclear blast and it doesn't destroy you immediately, like, nothing happens right away. But you're dead. You're walking and you're dead, and it's only a matter of time until that radiation finishes the work it's already begun. You don't even have to stay in the radiation anymore. It's just your body is going to slowly decay. And because, I mean, it's crazy what radiation is. You got these little teeny, tiny, tiny particles. They're so small. You can't see them. They're quantum, right? They're below our ability to see without tremendous machines to help us do this. And radiation is, they're flying at you like a wall of teeny, tiny particles. Can you imagine getting hit by a wall of marbles? Like, it would hit your whole body, right? Instead of hitting your whole body, it hits your atoms. It hits your cells at the cellular level, and just it busts holes in everything. And you start to leak. Now, and again, it's not the prettiest image ever, but it's kind of like what's happened with the cross. In the body of Jesus, dead, he busted a hole in creation, which he then broke himself back through with the resurrection. And all that happens now is just a waiting for that result to come to pass. And the place where it's first coming to pass is in you believing it to be true. Which is impossible, but by the work done on the cross, the Spirit now is able to tell you you're atoned for. And that is believable because he says so. And so you begin to believe. And, I mean, we're still on the sixth seal here, right? So that creation itself will come to an end, will come to a final conclusion. We're waiting in the midst of this, but what does it look like while we're here in the midst of this? You don't have a new seal. You have 144,000 sealed with the cross, right? Now, I mean, you do have the speaking of the seal, but there's not a new seal broken. You have the mark of the cross that is put upon the true Israel, the true saved and redeemed of God, who is a perfect number from both sides of the Testament of God, the Old and New Testament, 12 and 12, 144 times 1,000, God's perfect, complete number. And this number is so perfect and complete that we can't even count it in real time. But what we can do is see that it is the fulfillment of the casting off of all tyranny, which first is the devil and our sinfulness, so that as those who are purified, we wave palm branches of victory as we march back toward this better land, this better city, where we sing a song of everlasting reality. And it's in that song that we've been trapped for a little while now, right? Where we are before the throne of God day and night like the sons of Korah. But we are like those sons of Korah in the exile and the post-returned exile, where we're still waiting for the final completion. Here we have the promise and even some of the outward form, but it has not all come to pass. And yet there are more songs. There is more of Old Testament hope to remind us that it has come to pass, that it is complete, and that what we're awaiting, what we're looking for, is so good. It's so complete that it's not worth comparing. That whatever suffering we endure now, it's as nothing. Right, so 100-fold is a number that's impossible. You don't get 100-fold. This is where you plant one seed and you get 100 times as much out of that seed as the one seed, right? This is just not realistic, or at least it wasn't until we started cheating. And even, I would say, as a nutritionist, I'm not a professional, but the more I learn about it, the cheating hasn't been so good for us. But anyway, wholly different reality. It's not a realistic expectation. You don't invest a dollar and multiply it by 100 the next day. It doesn't happen. But the suffering of the great tribulation is going to be replaced by a pleasure that is 100-fold in the other direction. And that is what Revelation 7, 16, and 17 are attempting to convey to us by pulling on even greater language from particularly Isaiah, but also the Psalms of the Old Testament. And I think with 8 verse 1, this brings to a completion the seven seals. Because the seventh seal is actually chapter 8 verse 1. The question is, and I'm open to be disagreed with on this one, right? So does 8:1 have the seventh seal and it's just silence in heaven for about half an hour? Boom, end of story. Now we have a new story. Or, I mean, why did the monks put the numbers where they did? Because they think the seventh seal is opening what's going next. Well, okay, so what's going next? You're going to get a glimpse of the next two sevens, and then they're going to come one after the other. You're going to get a glimpse of angels with trumpets and an angel with a bowl of wrath. And then you're going to have seven events connected to those angels blowing their trumpets, and then you're going to have seven events connected to seven angels pouring out bowls of wrath from the altar of God in heaven. So is the seventh seal sort of just a flower opening to show these other sevens? And I'm okay with that. In fact, I used to kind of hold that idea, but I'm leaning more this other direction now, that we just have the verse marking in the wrong spot, and that the silence in heaven for about half an hour is one of the most potent ideas in the whole Bible. Although it's pretty hard to get scripture to interpret scripture on this one, but that's what we're going to try to do by the end of episode 2 of this little series here, right? But structure, right? So then you have, again, these seven, 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 and we're coming to the conclusion of the first seven, whether or not it opens in the next seven or not. We're coming to that conclusion now. So it's a major waypoint in the book itself. It's not quite halfway through, but it literally is like a third of the way through the book. But in saying that, then, there's one more piece you got to kind of keep in mind here, because this is a spiral going down into the same reality. We're drilling a hole in what is happening behind the history that we see with our eyes. That means we're already at the end of the world. And we just talked about this. I mean, it happened in Jesus, right? But it's also working itself out. And now we're seeing, or we're told, these events that will happen at the end of the world, that all that is evil will pass away and all is good will remain forever and ever. Amen, amen, amen. No scorching heat, every tear wiped away, that kind of thing. I mean, it's paradise. It's the eternity that we're waiting for. It's heaven, in scare quotes, after the last day. So we've gotten to the end of history already, and this is kind of what I'm trying to get at. So if you go forward now into chapter 8, not realizing that, you have to have another end of the world come up in about seven trumpets. And then another end of the world come up in about seven censers. Because what's happening is not a timeline of what to see before the end of the world. What's happening is this spiraling down, looking at the same event from three different angles well, it's really seven different angles three times, right? Over and over and over. So that you have to, when you go to the trumpets, and we'll say this again when we get to the trumpets, but when you go to the trumpets, it's like reboot. It's like, tell the story again. Have you ever watched a movie where like, I'm trying to think of one where it does this. I know I've seen one where, or read a book where the same event is told from three different perspectives and you're in like three different people's heads, seeing it all from their point of view and kind of getting, you know, maybe you don't like one of them in one person's point of view, but then you're like, oh no, they're a sympathetic character because if you see it from the other point of view, it's not exactly what's going on, but that's the structure, right? That's the structure that's going on here. So you gotta see, we are at the end of the world. We are at the end of the tribulation. The tribulation exists. It's going to be fixed in Jesus. And really, that's the bigger point than the timeline part. It's not even about being at the end of the world. It's about this main idea that John is preaching the entire time. That it's all been fixed in Jesus. The tribulation is here, but Jesus is the end of it already. It's way better, 100-fold better, once he comes again. Hopefully that helped get us there. So in the midst of this, again, picture of the redeemed, of who we are, both now, but not yet, you have this song. This song about our having been washed by the blood. This song about having our doorposts covered so that death will pass over us. The song about being in communion with God, literally holy in his presence, in proximity, set apart from the world by a connection we have to him, day and night. Literally a real presence. And of course, the Holy Supper has something to do with this. But what does this mean, both for us now by faith and in the future by sight? It means we sing. And don't get me wrong. The life of the world to come is not all of us just in a choir singing the entire time. I know musicians like to think that. God bless you, musicians. No, we're going to sing, but that's not all we do. The images that we have of the life of the world to come are images of life, like unto this world, but without sin. So that we're going to get everything that we were intended to be given here, but without the decay, without the travail, without the tribulation. You're going to eat and drink. You're going to walk. You're going to work, and it won't be labor. The paradise which was lost will be restored. And that is what we sing about. We sing about life. We do that now, too. It's just all often, usually, right? You listen to the pop stations, it's often kind of tinged with the fallenness of life. Then we shall sing of the goodness of life. And Revelation chapter 7's back end, the end part of this sixth seal, clinging to and pointing to the Psalms and then these very particular passages in Isaiah, is a pulling of those songs down from the future into our present reality. And it begins in chapter 7, verse 16, by pointing us back to the words of Jesus in Isaiah chapter 49, which then bleed over into the words of the psalmist in Psalm 121, verse 6. And our goal is to get through those two things in the next half hour. But it doesn't end there, because it continues into, in verse 17 of chapter 7 of Revelation, it continues into the imagery of Psalm 23, which has already been foreshadowed back in Isaiah 49, and then into Isaiah 24 and 25, which, while it does many things, and we'll talk about that stuff too in the next episode, the unique holding point, the linchpin that pulls all of us together, all those passages, is that running through all of them is the picture of a shepherd and his sheep, whom he seeks the welfare of, which just so happens to be the one bit of these two verses that doesn't have a direct parallel to any particular Old Testament text, that the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd. Now, of course, it does have parallel texts. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And he tells us what that means. It means that he lays down his life. He dies underneath the fangs of the wolf in order to save. And you also have this one particular figure in the Old Testament who is known as the shepherd of Israel. Both because, well, that was the job he had on the day that he became king. He went from being one caring for his father's sheep in the back pastures, little thought of by any, to being the ruler and reigner over all things. And then as ruler and reigner over all things, this man who used to be a shepherd of sheep now becomes a shepherd of people, a king. So that the very idea of Christ and kingship in the Old Testament becomes one of shepherding. When Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, I mean, he is saying, I'm the king. In Old Testament language, Old Testament parlance. So while there is no singular text that the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd really points to, it points to all of it, right? It points to the whole Old Testament. That, and we'll look at a little bit with David in this, but in the next episode, but it comes back to and comes down to what's called the Proto-Evangelion, the Proto-Gospel, the primordial gospel, the original promise given at the moment of the original sin, that there will be one man who will do all this. One man who will be the shepherd. And when we get to Isaiah 49 in just a moment, I want you to pull that forward with you, because Isaiah is seeing this at a point in time where it is narrowed and narrowed and narrowed down, but it still has a ways to go, and so he still has to look forward as well. But it starts back when there was nowhere to narrow, there was only a place to expand, and yet as it expanded, it didn't happen. It starts in Genesis chapter 3, where the tribulation of our sin is described in this way. And notice the inverse. The tribulation of our sin is described with gospel first and law second. The Lord God said to the dragon, yeah, it says serpent, but it's a dragon. The Lord God said to the dragon, because you have done this, what's this? Deceived, with malice sought to be God for yourself, cursed are you above all livestock, beasts of the field, animals, I'm going to say creation, cursed are you above all created things, above all the beasts that there are. On your belly you shall go. Now, yes, snakes do in fact go on their belly. There's certainly a reflection here. But that dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I think it's a little more than just about the snake's tongue licking up the dust. Remember, who is man? Who is Adam? What is he but the clod of dirt and dust? Remember, O Lord, that we are but dust. It is dust that the serpent shall have for himself to rule over. Not living men, but dead ones. But this isn't the end. I will put hatred, enmity, between you and, interesting, not the man, the woman, but it is the man, because it's through woman that man lives. Between you and the woman, and between your offspring, your seed, that is all that you have planted and sown with your lies, and between her offspring, her seed, one single egg from her womb, connected with what? Not one single sperm from a man. No. But in miracle of miracles, a zygote of its own, his father, the heavenly and almighty one, I will put hatred between you and this promise. And this promise that through the womb of woman will come one man, we shall see the result, which is that he shall bruise, shall crush, shall wound with an eternally mortal wound your head, even as you bruise, crush, wound with an immortal wound. His heel. Now, you know, an immortal wound at the heel, and a wound that always stays on your heel, well, it's not going to kill you, it's just going to hurt. That's why Jesus bears the scars. But a wound to the head, a crushed skull, well, that's the end of you. This is the primordial gospel, that one man, born of woman, will fix what we have wrought. Two things before we jump forward to Isaiah. Don't miss this. After the rest of the description of the tribulation is given from Adam and Eve's perspective, in the next two verses, Adam, he knows how bad it's going to be, but he also knows what God just said. He knows about this primordial gospel. And so he changes, well, I say it so wrongly, he changes Eve's name. No, he doesn't. Her name wasn't Eve yet. It is Adam and Eve are not in the garden. Adam, which we should maybe even not translate as Adam, man is his name. His name is man, dirt, right? It's the same word. Man, dirt, which we pronounce it as Adam in Hebrew. Man, dirt was in the garden. And then God brought him another one, a helper. And he says, oh, I like her. I'm going to name her kind of like man, dirt, but not in a feminine way. Right, which is the way you would say woman in Hebrew. Literally, it is kind of like man, but feminine. And so you have Adam and woman, right? Dirt man and woman version of him in the garden. And it is only after this moment when God says, out of this woman's seed, without man's help, I am going to bring forth a man who is different and better and a fixer of all, that Adam names her Eve, which is just the Hebrew word for life. He names her life because of the primordial gospel that will come from her womb. Now, the rest of that curse language that comes before he renames Eve is a description of the tribulation. It's the four horsemen of the apocalypse, just Old Testament style, which is that to the woman, he says, raising your children is going to be, well, it's going to suck. It's going to be hard. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt to bring them forth. It's going to hurt to bring them up. You're not going to want to do it. You're going to wish you were a man. You're going to try to let go of your job to be a woman your whole life long, but you won't be able to do it. In fact, the more that you do it, the worse he's going to become. He'll tyrannize you the more you attempt to be and rule him. And Adam, don't think you're off the hook here. Like, yeah, she ruined your relationship and all, but you ruined everything else. Because of you, cursed is the earth, the ground. Cursed is all that you do with your hands. Thorns and thistles will be here instead. You're going to sweat, and you're going to tribulate, and you're going to die. I've already given you to the serpent. From dust you were taken, and to the dust he shall eat. You shall return. And Adam's like, let's call you life from now on, because that's the better part of the message. Right? Right? So, okay, down through history then, this expands. It's clearly not Cain, right? Cain is not the one. Seth gets the promise again, and so it expands onward. But God then starts to bring it back over and over again. The more that mankind spreads throughout history, God keeps bringing back this promise of the seed. And it comes back through Noah. It comes back through Abraham. It comes back through Judah. It comes back through David. But in the exile, at the time of what we call Second Isaiah, and God willing, we'll have time, I'll tell you what that means. Where is this seed now? Yes, you have some of the extended children of David through the lineage of Jehoiachin, right, who was taken to Babylon, from whom eventually, right, Zerubbabel has that lineage, and then he brings people back and all that. Or you've heard these names before. I know they're hard names. I had to look them up again, too. But in that exile, things don't look really, really good. So where is this promise? And this is what Isaiah then, with his second book, and I'll explain that, where Isaiah is going to, having seen his prophecies of the destruction come to pass, or at least from afar seen them come to pass, he's going to point back to these promises as the answer to the captivity which God has put his people back into, that they would remember their need to be saved from the real captivity, which is that tyranny of the devil, the dragon slithering around eating us all. Not literally, but you know what I mean. So it was in the back half of the book of Isaiah, often called 2 Isaiah, that the prophet returns to this idea of Emmanuel, of God among us, a servant of God who will be born. He returns to it in full force with a series of songs that are referring to one called the servant of Yahweh, the servant of God. And this is far too complex a topic to possibly cover all of it for you today. But what I can tell you is that this servant who is introduced very early on after chapter 40, in chapter 49, it's brought back to him, and he starts to tell you what it means with his own mouth, like the words of Jesus in the Old Testament. Now, before we go to that, though, let me give you, though, I promised I'll explain 2 Isaiah. So here's the thing. It's really, really obvious that there's a break between Isaiah chapter 39 and Isaiah chapter 40. And you just have to trust me on this one. And I'm not even a Hebrew scholar. I've only kind of looked at this in the English listening to Hebrew scholars, but it just shifts. There is a massive change. It's almost like it's a different author, to the point that the liberals in the 18th century, because they just hated the Bible, they start saying it is a different author. This is from later. It's so evident that this is dealing with the needs of the exile that it had to be written during the exile, and we know Isaiah didn't live there. Well, no. What this could be is that later in his life, knowing the exile is coming, and seeing the writing on the wall, as it were, Isaiah prophesies and writes again because God tells him to, and he does have a different angle because he also knows he's going to die soon and that the real exile of his death is one he wants to come back from, and he's even preaching to himself in this matter. So you don't have to buy the liberal argument, but you do have to recognize there is a shift in the language and a shift in direction and a shift in the preaching. And remember this too. The book of Isaiah, we talked about this way back when. Is it a complicated beast of a book because it doesn't give you titles. It doesn't give you chapter headings. And it's certainly not linear. What happens is at some point in his life, Isaiah takes everything that he's ever preached and he patches it together into a bit of an orchestral story. And really is two. It's two symphonies, right? One is chapter 1 through 39, and one is chapter 40 through 66. Two symphonies that both have a direction which they go, but which it would be nice if there were some editorial introductions that he had put in place, but he doesn't. And so instead you have to study it and figure out what those things are for yourself. And that is easier said than done, but that's what we're trying to do here a little bit. So let's say this then. Second Isaiah, when I say that, I do not mean it's not from Isaiah. I mean, it's like Isaiah's second book. You know how you have First and Second Samuel? They're actually one book, right? Same kind of idea, right? So it is chapters 40 through 66, through the end of the book, with a theme that, as opposed to being primarily dominated by judgment, is primarily dominated by deliverance. Now, deliverance shows up before this for sure, and judgment shows up after this for sure, but it's like he's turned down the other side of the mountain. So maybe it's one symphony with two massive movements. And if you know much about music, right, a movement that you have a melody that dominates the first movement and a melody that dominates the second movement. Sometimes you bring back the first movement again for a third movement, but let's just say that there's an interplay between them, but now we're into this new movement and the theme is a melody of deliverance. This melody of deliverance, this movement, has three of its own little movements, each one with its own variation on the theme, its own major thought or keynote. And each of these keynotes is a thesis against its antithesis. It's an answer to a question. So first, chapter 40 through 48 is the contrast between God the Lord and all the idols of the world, between Israel as those who are under God and the heathen as those who are not under God, again with an emphasis on the deliverance by God of Israel. This is going to be entirely couched in language about being brought back out of Babylon into the promised land through the leadership of Cyrus of Persia. In the second part, in chapters 49 through 57, the contrast is between the suffering of the servant of God in saving and the glory that results from that salvation. How the way of salvation as work done by the servant of the Lord, Jesus, this one man we're waiting for, and we're going to get to that, right? That's the whole point here. But it's a way through deep humiliation and exaltation into glory, that the guilt of the world will be expiated by the self-sacrifice of God's shepherd. And in the third part, chapters 53 through 66, the contrast is the difference between or within the heart of Israel itself. Oh man, and Israel is something we could go off on a huge tangent as what that means, but let's just say for the moment, Israel is you and me. Israel is all those who believe because God has fought for us and on our behalf. Yet within the Israel that is seen, there is also those who are not Israel. You have the hypocrites, the depraved, the rebellious, right? So within the church, you have those who do not believe. Within Old Testament Israel, you have those who do not believe. They're not true Israel. So the contrast here is between the real believer, the faithful, the one who mourns in the present age, the one who was persecuted, and the false believer, the one who lies even to himself as he worships not the city which is coming, but the city which is now. And more of that language coming down the way, probably in the next episode. But what ultimately kind of comes about here in this third part, this third movement of Isaiah's second great movement, second Isaiah, is that there is a condition for participation in redemption, and that condition is believing you are redeemed. It's believing that the work God does for you is the work God does for you. The assurance that the tribulation right now is not worth comparing, which the hope, the exceeding weight of glory that is soon to be revealed. Now, according to Kyle and Dillich, all of this is done in metric terms within the Hebrew. He calls them circular movements of 3x9 addresses. I honestly don't know what that means. But I think what it does mean is that the back end of Isaiah is as structured as I was just saying Revelation is with these numbers. It's not about how long things are. It's how we think of chapters. It's about how many ideas there are and these little bits of numbers that would be left to kind of point the way. Now, before we leave this idea of 2nd Isaiah, just keep this in mind then, though. So from this point on in the book, from chapter 40 to the end, Isaiah is doing the kind of prophecy we normally think of as prophecy. We think of prophecy a bit wrong. We think of prophecy as only being about telling the future. That's not what prophecy is. Prophecy is repeating what God has said. If God tells you something about the future, then you can repeat what he has said and tell the future. That's what he's doing now from 40 to 66. But what he was doing before this, some of it was telling the future, but some of it was telling the present very, very clearly, right? That Isaiah as prophet was speaking directly to events taking place in his own time, not millions of miles away. From 40 on, he's talking about millions of miles away. First, the exile and the actual return from it. So the people who would read this second book of Isaiah in exile would cling to the hope that Christ is going to come and restore us to the land, and that you and I would see that that was only a temporary fulfillment, a temporal, typological fulfillment of the greater reality that the proto-evangelized son of woman is going to come and restore us to the paradise. In this then, Isaiah chapter 49 is the beginning of that second section that contrasts the work of the Messiah, the work of the servant of God, which is to suffer, with the result of his work, which is to bring pleasure eternal. Now, this character has already been introduced to us in 2 Isaiah back in chapter 42, and we've looked at this before, but let me just remind you of the words. You're going to recognize it. He says, "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my elect, whom my soul loves. I have set my spirit upon him to bring out faith, true religion, mishpat, to the nations, to the Gentiles. His voice will not cry out, nor lift up, nor cause it to be heard in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a glimmering wick he will not put out. According to truth, he brings out the true religion, the true right. He will not become faint or broken till he establishes right upon the earth, and the islands wait for his doctrine. I, the Lord, have called him in righteousness, grasped him by the hand to keep him, to make him a covenant for the peoples, to open blind eyes, to bring prisoners out of the prison, and to those who sit in darkness, freedom from the shadow. Now, I paraphrased that a bit. I was working off Kyle and Dalich's actual translation. I skipped the mines and the comeths and all those kinds of things. But, okay, so, chapter 49 has this guy start talking. And it doesn't tell you that. It doesn't say, and the servant of the Lord is going to talk now. Instead, he just talks. And by context, you kind of have to figure out, well, who's talking right now? There's times when the Old Testament does this. Psalm 2 is an example. The first half of the psalm is, I'm going to tell you about the king. And then the second half of the psalm is the king speaking. He just, I will do this, he just says. And you got to just recognize that it's the one who's been being talked about who now is talking. That's now happening here. Remember how it was... In him, the islands are going to hope, too. He says in chapter 49, verse 1, listen, O islands, then. Hearken, all ye nations. And the islands are always an image of the deep paganism, those who are far away from God, the Phoenicians and those like them. Listen, the Lord has called me out of the womb. I mean, did you get that? I'm called from the seed of woman. From my mother's lap he has named me, even as the angel came to Mary and said, you shall call his name Jesus. From my mother's seed I am named, but my mouth is like a sharpened sword, and in the shadow of his hand he hides me like a polished spear. I'm in the quiver, concealed. Oh man, there's so much you can do with that. Well, think about why is an arrow in the quiver? So that it's ready to be used and not to be lost. And yet you also think about how it's hidden. You can't see it. A sword or a knife in a sheath on your body can be concealed and not hidden. Even as he is going to say, now I am concealed where? I am hidden where? I am in the suffering. But that suffering is the strike of sword and spear against all evil, against the head of the serpent, with the wound of his heel to crush him. Listen, Jesus says in Isaiah 49, verse 5, the Lord who formed me from my mother's seed, from the womb, to be his servant, did so that I would bring back Jacob. Jacob is Israel, but Jacob's name doesn't mean God fights for you. That's what Israel means. Jacob's name means deceiver. To bring back the deceiver, the children of the deceiver, you, to him. That those same people, Israel, the ones whom I fight, might be gathered together. And don't miss the ecclesiology, the called out gathering, churching going on there. Gathered together to him. This is my honor. This is my strength. He has said, it's a small thing to be my servant and save only the Hebrews. You're going to save the entire world. You're going to be a light to the nations. And certainly you want to think about Jesus standing up at the middle of the Feast of Tabernacles, and he shouts out, I am the light of the world. I mean, this is not just saying, hey, I'm kind of a special dude. I got the Gnostic light of truth in me. No. He's using Old Testament language. I am the Messiah, the servant of the Lord, the one you've been waiting for. But back in Isaiah 49, verse 7, he says, this is what God has said about me, the Redeemer of Israel, his Holy One, that I will be the abhorrence of the people, a servant of tyrants. But kings shall see it and rise up. The nobility shall see it and bow down, because this is how he has chosen me. Now, what's going on there? Well, this is just it. The abomination of the cross. I am to be contempted. I am to despair. I am to cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And yet this will make the greatest, the most powerful, the rulers of the earth. Well, those who see, those who have ears to hear, they will resurrect. They will believe. Even as those who put much upon themselves, they will be cast down from their thrones. In faith, their knees will bow. The servant goes on, this is what God says about me. In a time of favor, I have heard you. Even as you pray, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. In a day of salvation, I have helped you, formed you to be a, here it is again, covenant. A contract by which I raise up the land, by which I give again inheritances back to the desolate, by which I say to the prisoners, get out of the prison, and by which I say to those in darkness, come ye to the light. Now, all of that is to get us to chapter 49, verse 9, in which we're just going to get the tip of the iceberg of what's got to follow next week, but hopefully we'll complete this song of Revelation 7 for us. What happens next is Jesus himself begins to say what will be the result of his work to save you, to save us. He describes his church, and he says it this way. He says, they shall feed beside the roads, and there will be pasture for them upon every hilltop. They shall not hunger nor thirst anymore. Oh, catch that. That's the verse. That's the bit right there. They shall not hunger nor thirst anymore. The mirage and the sun shall not blind them, for God will have had mercy upon them to lead them and guide them by springs of bubbling water. I will make even the high mountaintops roads for them, and the valleys shall be lifted up as a path. Look how they come from afar. See, from the north, and even from the west and the south, the far-off lands of the sea, more than that, from the eastern edges of all that is, from those of the Sinese, which, well, is an ancient name for China. And I don't have time here today to defend that. You got to look it up in Kyle and Delitzsch if you want to. And yeah, granted, it's old research, but I think it's pretty fair. Either way, the point is, from everywhere they shall come. They shall take to their homes as homes that will never come down, obtaining sufficient pasture at all times. Even upon bare and sandy hilltops, there will be clean grass for the sheep, that's you, to eat. Nothing shall be wanting. The sun won't harm you. And again, that's language. We got to go back to Revelation with this language. The sun will not harm you, for you will be led by springs of refreshing and living water. So when John comes along and has all the hosts of all that will ever be saved singing about being before the throne of God, sheltered in his presence, that we will hunger no more, neither thirst any more, that the sun shall not strike us, nor any scorching heat, that we will be guided to springs of living water, it's because we are now under the care of a shepherd, that we have become a flock. And so while Isaiah has given us the insight into who is doing this, the servant of the Lord, prophesied of old, the one man born of woman who shall crush the head of the serpent, we've only scratched the surface of the endless stream of flickering Old Testament imagery that, like a commercial, moving fast and using all the music in just the right way, can move you in a moment to recall everything that ought to be until you don't just know about this primordial gospel. You don't just think about this primordial gospel. You don't even just feel this primordial gospel until you are swallowed alive by it. And in that, being swallowed by life, by the seed born of life, having the thorns, the thistles, the sweat, the divisions, the animosity, the discontent, the being those who are but dust, once swallowed and eaten by that old wicked serpent. Crushed beneath the wounds of one man's pierced heel.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.